to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
And welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on his land we are broadcasting from. I also like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a big shout out to everybody from around the continent who is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service NIRS, or if you're tuning in via our app 98.9 FM for the best country, which you can download for free from your app store, so please do so. And don't forget, this program is streamed via our website. So that's 98.9fm.com.au. And this program also is podcasted, so you can listen to previous Let's Talk programs. You can also catch us via Spotify and Apple Podcasts, those platforms beaming us into your communities. And as always, it is great to have your company. On the program, I chat with Professor Peter Reed. To some, that name may sound very familiar. In 1981, he wrote a book titled The Stolen Generation, The Removal of Aboriginal Children in New South Wales in 1883 to 1969. And that was published, as I mentioned, by Professor Peter Reed. He is also instrumental in working in Link Up in New South Wales, and he'll talk a bit more about some of the stuff that he has done. It was amazing talking to Peter as well, just to learn this history, you know, go deep into when they first started taking Aboriginal children on this continent. This program starts by me asking a bit about Peter, who he is and what he does.
My name is Peter Reed. I live in Canberra, and I've been involved in Aboriginal history since about 1970, I suppose. And I work a retired professor of history, and I work particularly in our Centre for Indigenous Studies at the ANU. And I'm still very much involved in the question of the Stolen Generations, and I'm lucky enough to be a member of the board, governing body of Link Up at the present time.
One of the reasons why I wanted to speak with you, because your wealth of knowledge around the Stolen Generation, how did you get involved in the discussion for the Stolen Generation or about the Stolen Generation?
Well, it really happened, I guess, in the 1970s. I was recording oral histories of Aboriginal people, my partner Jay Arthur, and we were, you know, as you'd imagine, in the 1970s, still a lot of stories of massacres and seeing their fathers killed and seeing white people for the first time. But also, there were stories of people who had been brought in by the mission stations and had been raised by missionaries, often never saw their parents again. Now, we had no thought of anything like the Stolen Generations then. We'd always been raised to think that missionaries were good people, and they brought young Aboriginal kids in, and they grew up and either had a bad time or a good time. But you know, the concept of removed children in general, or let alone stolen Aboriginal children, was quite a foreign one. You sort of, in some ways, you need to get your head around a concept, and I think white Australia had a long time getting its head around that concept as well. We collected a number of stories, and they just went into a book about we were taken by missionaries and we had a good time or didn't, and so on. Then when I started working in New South Wales, the same thing happened. I was actually writing a history of the Wiradjuri people of New South Wales, and also working in Cowra, which is in Wiradjuri country. And there were a lot of stories of people being removed there from the homes, but not by missionaries so much, but just being removed anyway, and then sometimes coming back again to a happy reunion, sometimes they never came home again. And it was beginning to form in my mind that there was something you could sort of, in a sense, put a ring around all these stories, and they make a kind of sense. But at the same time, I was working, I spent a lot of time at what used to be called the Institute of Aboriginal Studies in Canberra. It's now called IAPSIS. And there I met a woman who was making a film about her own life. At the time, her name was Coral Edwards, but she's known as Umbra Edwards now. And she was making a film about herself as a Cootamundra girl. As your listeners will probably know, Cootamundra is the principal home for Aboriginal girls in New South Wales and was for about 60 or 70 years, while Kinchilla was a boys' home. Anyway, she was making a film about her own life, and she'd been removed at the age of about 5 months and raised in the home and knew very well what the consequences were of being removed when you didn't remember anything about your family. She had a sister there who remembered a little bit more, but not all that much more, really, because her sister Lola had been taken pretty young as well. Anyway, to cut a long story short, Coraline is, or Umbra, as she has now, asked me to take her back to Tinga, where she came from, to help her find a family. And we did that. And I went with her, and we spent a fortnight on the road visiting Tinga, meeting her family, went to Newcastle, met her mum. And at the end of it, we realised that there was something really important going on here, and she suggested to me, let's start an organisation called Link Up. And this is about 1980, I think it was. And we'll try, and we only thought initially of her friends in Cootamundra. I know most of them haven't been back. Some of them don't even know actually who they are. They know their family name, but don't even know where they come from or don't know anything about their families. So let's start an organisation which will help that. So there's more to be said, of course, than saying, well, we started it, but we did. And I suppose one more thing to add. There was a government group called the Family and Children's Service Agency in Sydney, which Umra and I spent a fair bit of time talking to them, and they said to me, Peter, could you write a little history of what had happened about these stolen kids? I said, sure. And I put together a little pamphlet called The Stolen Generations. I have to be fair to my partner, Jay, here, because I called it The Lost Generations, and passed at the end of the day, I'd been finished writing it, I passed it across to her, and she said, yeah, that's all very well, but bloody hell, these kids are stolen, not lost. I said, yeah, you're right. Okay, thank you, Jay. So I crossed it out, and it became The Stolen Generations, and that's how the pamphlet was published, and that's how, really, it all began in about 1980-81.
How long did this process of stealing children, when did it start, and when did it officially finish?
Okay, I like to think of it as starting when Governor Macquarie set up his institution for Aboriginal children in Windsor, just outside of Sydney, in 1814. And he said to the parents, bring your kids in, please, and we'll show them what a nice place this is. And the kids were happy enough, and the parents seemed to be happy enough because they were going on ceremonies and going hunting and whatever. Well, after a few months, they came back again and said, oh, thanks very much for looking after the kids. We'll have them back now. What? Didn't we explain? No, the kids don't go home again. No, they're here now. I'm saying it sound a little bit facetious, but of course it wasn't. That's pretty exactly how it happened. The parents mostly volunteered to put their children in because they didn't know what was going on, and they didn't know what the implications were of putting your placing your children there. And very soon after that, of course, the missionaries were out, not just the missionaries from Blacktown, but other places, were heading, this is from Windsor or Blacktown, they were heading out into the bush, rounding up children, bringing them into the mission and leaving them there. So we really can date it from 1814.
That's pretty early, the first, you know, fleet, lands, docks, and then 20 years, over 15 years, you know, they start, you know, actively sort of taking kids.
That's right, yeah, in a formalised way. That's right, yeah. It hadn't been formalised until then. There were a lot of quite good-hearted people who took kids into their homes and tried to raise them. Of course, we think that was good-hearted, but what they were trying to do was turn them into good little agricultural labourers and so on, and they probably loved them as well. There'd been a certain amount of them, but it wasn't formalised in this way until 1814 when Governor Macquarie really got his school. But you couldn't say that the 19th century was famous for removing children until the three of the state bureaucracies get into action. And that's generally around the 1880s, 1870s in Victoria, really the earliest ones. But New South Wales, South Australia, Queensland, they're all in the game by 1890. They've all got their state bureaucracies set up to take away children and raise them as, in the end, to raise them as white kids. If they can't be white kids, they can certainly act like white kids and, in other words, be useful to us and not get in the way. And so that's really the trajectory. And so the main time for removing kids is really from the time these bureaucracies get up, say around about 1880, up to the time when the criticism is growing louder and louder and the expense is growing louder and louder that children should not be removed in this way. And that really, it starts winding down from about 1970 onwards. But of course, the practice hasn't ended yet, but it's more on an individual basis rather than inspectors sort of scouring the district and rounding up all the kids he could find.
In your research and in your eyes, and what do you think the intent or the purpose was, you know, when removing children?
It was pretty clearly to put an end to their aboriginality or part aboriginality and to raise them with as white children. So there are various ways of doing this. One was back in Blacktown in 1814, was to say, look, these kids don't have a chance. It'd be much better if they can marry Aboriginal people themselves. We'll take Aboriginal girls in and they'll meet Aboriginal men and they will get married and they will have a better chance of getting on the colony, because everyone knows that these so-called half-castes, sorry to use that word, but that's the word that we use, of course, these so-called half-castes don't have a chance. Everyone pushes them around and despises them. But if they're coming of the full descent with two black parents, well, they'll have a better chance. Well, somebody's honest endeavour to make things better. But, of course, it didn't last very long because there weren't enough Aboriginal men to go around, for one thing, because more girls were being brought in. So it was the driving force, I think, actually, in many cases, was the so-called, quote, uprising of a wild race of half-castes, unquote. Particularly, this was used a lot in the Territory and some parts of northern Queensland. If you let these people, I'm sorry, it's such offensive words to be using. If you let these people keep on breeding, we're going to produce half-castes. Only the worst of whites will breed with the half-castes. Isn't it appalling? I'm blushing as I say this. Only the worst of whites will breed with Aboriginal women. They'll produce the worst kind of person who'll be half-castes, and they'll all rise up and overwhelm us. Typically, the Territory just didn't have a very big white population.
So while this process was going off, I guess we can even talk as early as sort of, you know, 1814, Aboriginal people were put in these institutions by missionaries.
Initially by missionaries who were trying to teach the word of God to them. That's right. Mm-hmm. But their influence is pretty well faded by the 1840s, at least in New South Wales and inner Queensland, because the missionaries find that more and more, as soon as you set up a mission station, the white fellows come round and they start paying wages to their Aboriginal staff and entice the good ones away. And also they get a bit cheeky to you because they realise the missionaries aren't all these all-powerful people. So the missionaries would pack up their belongings and go another 200 miles further out into the bush. And so that's why the Northern Territory missions don't really start until the 1870s, and they're still flourishing, 1890s into the turn of the century. It's a question of missionaries in the beginning, but by the time the state bureaucracy takes over in the 1870s, there's not much goodwill left there. There really is not.
Whatever sort of time period between sort of, I guess, the late 70s, 60s, 1960s, 1970s, after the 1814 or even 1840s, 50s, in certain areas, they start taking children and they put them in these institutions. What happens to these children in these institutions? What are they doing? You're teaching them religion? Are they saying you can't speak your language? You have to cut your hair, or you have to do certain things a certain way?
Yeah, definitely. Of course, the emphasis on religious education is greatest when the missionaries have got them. By the time you get to, Cootamundra or Kinchula in 1920, there's a compulsory chapel on Saturdays, but on Sundays rather, but I don't get much more than that. No, the emphasis is far more on, we want to provide the minimum of education for these kids. So the most you can get to in New South Wales by 1950 is what they used to call the intermediate certificate, which would get you a job as a factory girl. Well, back in Charlie Perkins' time, he was being raised in the bungalow in the 1940s, well, the education level was much, much lower. Or if you could read and write there, that's all they cared about, because the girls could, at that point, become go and work in a household, and the boys could become ringers. Or I think in Uncle Charlie's case, they set him off to be a boilermaker. And most of the kids who are going through that too. So the education level depended on what part of the state and what part of the country we're talking about. But basically, it was the minimum. The Aboriginal kids weren't expected to be very smart. And anyway, we don't want them to be very smart, because we want them to be good enough to go and be ringers out in the bush or to be house girls. We don't want their education level to be any higher than that. So it's generally they're not pretty places, of course, as we all know, and partly because the education level's so low and you're not expected to do anything, and partly because when you come in, you could be a happy, bright, happy child. By the time you leave, often they're described as dull or sort of stupid and depressed. Well, as the environment, of course, made them that way.
We hear stories of, you know, excruciating abuse that was, you know, carried out in these institutions to these people. You know, physical, mental, and obviously sexual abuse happened in these institutions. With that as well, what age do they usually leave, you know, these the institutions?
Yeah. Between about 13 and 15. As soon as you're old enough to work, out, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the majority of the time, like as you mentioned, in certain parts of Queensland, I guess ringers or pastoralists will sort of, you know, come by and have an interest in sort of some of the young boys and wanting them to work.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yes, they would.
There's always work there, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And they'd come around and say, "Oh, they'd write a letter, say, oh, look, I need a couple of boys, please. Can you send them out? I live at this property here," and somebody would take them out there. And basically leave them there, which is okay for the boys. They might think, well, I'm glad we're out of that terrible bloody institution. But for girls, of course, this was a real signal for sexual exploitation. Not so much in the homes, because you generally had matrons who were to make sure it didn't happen. But as soon as the girls got out, it was on for young and old. They had a terrible time, and even if the matron came out to inspect as a place to be safe for the girls, well, as soon as they turned their back, there's the all the lads in the station were saying, "Oh, well, you can imagine what they were saying." And most of the terrible things happened as soon as the carer's back was turned.
What policies was passed to give full rights to each state to have rights over the children, and how did that work?
Well, the Commonwealth didn't, until the referendum, the Commonwealth didn't have any powers at all over, that's the 1967 referendum, it didn't have any powers over Aboriginal issues really at all. Some education powers, but that didn't affect them. So if the states had the power in themselves, either through education policies or through the Minister for Welfare or Child Protection, or that was given various names. And so any child that could be brought before a magistrate and declared a state ward, that meant you were under the so-called protection of the minister, who would generally send you through the bureaucracy, send you to the homes. And that's where you'd stay until they let you out again at the age of 13, 15, or whatever it happened to be. So it was all the state administration, really, except, of course, in the territory. But that was really, the territory was run by South Australia for so long, and so that was really, Commonwealth didn't really enter into it very much at all.
And this went on for quite a period of time, quite a long time in our country's history. The intent was to create, I guess, new Australians, or sort of, you know, a new identity within sort of these Aboriginal people. In some people's eyes, call that a genocide, or would you call it sort of genocide? What was the intent of what happened?
No, I used to call it genocide, but But like Sir Ron, if you remember Sir Ron Wilson in these bringing the Stolen Generations, Bring Them Home report, he used the word too, and there was a real rumpus about that. He said, look, if you want to use the word genocide, you can. I think that was probably a mistake on his part, because genocide literally is taking out people and killing them. I know there's a bit of argument about what the word means, but basically to me, that's what it is. So, as I said, I used to use the word genocide. If you want to use ethnocide, that is to put an end to an ethnic identity, that's probably a bit more accurate, because the children, generally speaking, aren't actually being killed. They're just having whatever this... If you think of a blackboard, you're born with a blackboard of a number of and your genetic inheritance and what you've known, what you've taught, everything up to the age of, say, five. Well, someone's rubbing it off completely and writing new secrets, new identities, new ways of belonging, new philosophy of life. That's what's being written on the blackboard. So it's still the same person, but in a fundamental way, they could be quite different. And that's why all through when I was working in Linkup as a field officer, back through the 80s and 90s really, and we came across so many people who'd only just discovered they were Aboriginal because it had been concealed of them when they were adopted, as it was supposed to have been. Mm. And then in various ways, the secret gets out, and then they're in terrible bind saying, well, who the hell am I then? If I'm not a member of the family like I thought I was, well, who am I? And that begins a long search back again, as you know. It can be a very, very painful search. But sometimes it's a very joyful one.
At what time do they sort of say, hey, you know, this practice that we're doing isn't working and we want to sort of stop taking these children?
It was mainly towards the end of the 70s when it's partly that the homes are getting too expensive, to put it cynically. The homes are getting very expensive to run. The government wants to wrap them up. Secondly, the assimilation policy, that is that everyone should turn into the mainstream Australia, was being questioned. But I suppose the voice that had been around for many decades saying, look, these children don't have a chance of ever having a happy life. That voices were getting louder and louder. And so for instance, in New South Wales, that's the one I know best, the Aboriginal Protection Board rolled it. It was abolished in 67. A new organisation was set up called the, I've forgotten the name, that was rather similar, but didn't have the power to remove children anymore. The minister still had power to remove children, but it wasn't specifically aimed at Aboriginal children anymore, which effectively the previous policies had been. But of course, it was replaced by court orders and all that kind of thing. And, of course, you can find yourself in court and the magistrate or the judge has to decide whether you're going to be placed with your Aboriginal granny because your parents, or maybe your mum's on drugs and dad's in jail, or your white father. And so yeah, there's always a debate about the relative merits of an Aboriginal identity and the rights to an Aboriginal identity and the rights to being who you are in the question of who the magistrate finally, or the judge says, finally allots how much time to whom. And so simply not removing kids in 1970 didn't put it, just ending the Aboriginal legislation, of course, didn't stop, as we all know, the practice of removing kids and finding them still incarcerated or in care or with foster homes or whatever.
And that was my chat with Professor Peter Reed. If you've enjoyed that chat and you'd like to share it or listen to it again, you can head to our website at 989fm.com.au and follow the links to the podcast, because the show will be up a little bit later on in the day. As always, you know, it's a pleasure. This has been Let's Talk here on 989FM Murray Country.
Life comes with its fair share of challenges and moments that are stressful or get us down. Sometimes we are so overwhelmed with our busy lifestyles, we don't even know why we are feeling down. It can be for a short time or an extended period. Our mental health affects how we think, feel, and act. It can also determine how we handle stress, connect with others, and make choices every day. It's important for us to look after our mental health during every stage of life. If you haven't been feeling like yourself, it can help to reach out to others in your family or social circle. If you're unsure who to yarn with, then reach out to your local AMS for advice and support. They can put you in touch with the right people to help you get back on track. To find your nearest AMS, visit www.iuih.org.au/clinics.
A message from the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health.
Station sponsor.